the subject of this evening's talk is, where is home? It's fairly normal and rather natural in our world to conceive of home in a particular way. And the first kind of impression which arises, what we call home, would probably be in a particular place. And the language of home arises inside of us, and we think to home. The attention goes to a particular locality, and images and pictures and associations go with that. And that's our perhaps settled base, so to speak. And through the association with what we refer to as home, we build up and we add things and we contribute things and we change things and we have people come and stay, etc. And it's a world which becomes a familiar world with various goods and items and memories. And all this becomes home. And obviously for countless, numerous men, women and children on the earth, home matters, and sometimes mattering in a way more than anything else. But with the sense of home as well, that the present feelings and appreciations which can arise with it, it also can have its boundaries as well. And the mind can generate boundaries, not because they truly are self-existent, but the boundaries are made by agreements with other people's minds. You say, well, I live here, and this is my place, and next door lives my neighbour, and that's her or his place. And the reference point is the garden fence. As a garden or whatever, landing or whatever. The mind moves, establishes itself, has a dimension to it, it has a size to it, a locality to it. It has that which is not my home, and that relationship is ongoing. And we know that that relationship can build up very, very strongly. And it's not unusual for men and women to say that one of the major decisions of life is actually going from one's home to a new home, to moving home, moving house, moving apartment, or whatever. The sense of my, of course, can be very strongly associated with my home. And therefore, what matters is my home more than the neighbours, more than others, near or far. An example of that story often told of the businessman working in his office, and he received an urgent telephone call saying that his house was on fire. And he said, understandably, not my home, my house, my possessions, my goods, my antiques, my this, my that, and went racing down the stairs out of the office, jumped into a car and started zooming off towards his home. And being one of those with one of those portable phones, received a phone call saying mistake was made, not your house. And he said, oh, thank God, it's not my home. So all the fear, the terror, the worry, the anxiety suddenly disappeared. Not my home. It's your neighbour's. Somebody else's home is on fire. It's just the wrong number. Of course, when he gets there, the fire has spread to his home. My home, my home, my home. So we enter into a very dualistic world. And we believe in that world. Mine and not mine. And it's a world fraught with problems. Not only do we believe in that possessive ownership aspect of the my that goes with it. But we can have the conceit, arrogance, in fact, of that world and what goes with it as being the real world. And it's not unusual for people in other circumstances, such as being in a retreat, who are leaving and then saying to themselves or foolishly to people like me, but when I go back into the real world, and there are people who are claiming that living in the real world is working every hour God sends from Monday to Friday, going home, collapsing in front of the television, getting out the vodkas, orange or whatever's in the refrigerator where people keep these things or whatever, and then recovering over the weekend, and back on Monday, and being in that cycle with, you can see, it is living in the real world. So if one's coming on a retreat or something else, it can be viewed as an escape. So there's more than just living in a house and living in a home and having some items there. Something's going on in the self, which is kind of having an overlay of it. And one of the things which goes with that is, quite naturally and easily, there is the wish to expand what one has. And one's eyes fall on those huge new apartment blocks that are being built in outside the edge of Tel Aviv, which are here very expensive, and or more space or whatever. And quite often one only needs a bigger home because one's got so many damn possessions, there's nowhere left for them. So one has to go into huge debt to fill up. So there's this wish, this goes on, to expand and expand further. And we see that, of course, with possessions, with time off, or with making money, or having more, or securing more, or whatever. But perhaps it's a misplaced perception. The wish to expand to something greater is there, but it's going and channeling itself in a particular way. And it's a kind of a wanting to add more to the notion of my. The my is never satisfied. There's always much more outside of the my, obviously. So I can have my home, my kids, my money, my job, my career, my retirement pension, and even pay for my funeral box, or whatever it might be. But there's always that much more, infinitely more, outside what any human being can have and claim as mine. The effect of which is that no matter how much we accumulate for ourselves, how much I have, how much is mine, it's never fulfilling. It's never satisfying. And the irritation inside and the itch inside keeps going. And one sees, not only with young people, but elderly people as well, still wheeling and dealing on the stock exchange. Still thinking of how to get more or whatever, usually an excuse called grandchildren, but it's for me and my family. And there's no place to stop. And maybe it's not only the movement towards the my, not only is it a misplaced sense of expansion that's going on, but maybe that isn't really home at all. Maybe home, to be really at home, is somewhere else altogether, something else altogether. As we know, now looking at life, our relationship to life, some people hear the word home, it's maybe the case with some of you, and it isn't pleasant associations. and pleasant recollections, or whatever, is decidedly unpleasant. One thinks of home, one thinks of, oh no. And there's a different kind of response. Years ago, the Tibetan lamas used to tell their Western students, as they have told their Tibetan students for years and centuries, think of all that your mother has done for you. Or they'll quote the Buddha, who said, in the relationship to mother and father, if we carried our mother on one shoulder and our father on the other shoulder all the way around the world, we couldn't repay the debt to them. When you are thinking of compassion, the Tibetan lamas say, think of all that your mother has done for you all day and all night, and all that she's given, and all the sacrifices that she's made. And there were Western students sitting in the audience who are going, not in my case. And some of the lamas had to stop using the analogy of loving, caring, supportive, home and mother and father and a wonderful home life, because some children and coming into adults, as some of you know very well, some of us know very well, say, hey, that's not my memory. When I say my mother, she said to me some years ago, she said, what's your memory of your upbringing? Dreadful question to ask. And I said, well, my prime major memory is yelling, shouting, slamming of doors, arguments, worries about money, 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 and never a moment's peace. That's my memory of my childhood. She said, it wasn't like that. I said, well, why ask me? And she said, well, there's occasionally little differences. So she telephoned my sister, who lives in Australia, which tells you something straight away. And she didn't mention what she said to Judy, that's my sister's name, she said, Judy, she said, what's your memory of your childhood? My sister said, arguing, yelling, shouting, slamming up the door. She said, oh no! So sometimes the memory is there. You and I, we have our memories. And sometimes, in spite of all that argumentative tension, unpleasantness of home life, sometimes too, in spite of all of that, we see also that which we can appreciate, and the struggles and the difficulties our parents went through and what they inherited, etc., etc. Helps to put in place some of all the terrible unpleasantness that can be associated for some people with their home life and their past or present circumstance. All of that, past and present, of course, does have its impact and its influence upon us. And sometimes we say those who become parents are never going to behave like my parents did. I know how not to parent, at least I learned that, and etc. But unless we have a lot of self-understanding, unless we understand ourselves well, of course we can easily repeat history. Maybe our parents said the same of their parents, right back to Adam and Eve, or the monkeys. Actually, it's a bit of an insult to monkeys. So you say, okay, if home is a kind of restricted, confined sense of my in a certain location in time and place, if home is a restriction, perhaps I can explore and look in another way to a sense of what being at home might mean. For some, the uprooting is important in all of this. Uprooting meaning, what's not, the capacity in life to expand oneself in places, times, situations, associations, contact, here and there. And that sometimes that uprooted sense, the period of time, withers, tires away, so to speak, normal sense of home. And one might, as it were, feel much more at home in various places in the world, much more at home with various people that one likes and appreciates, much more at home in various ways of being in this world. And so the sense of being at home isn't so narrow and restricted. It's actually expanding itself to a greater sense of being at home. Sometimes that greater sense of being at home shows itself a step further, and it might be, which wonderful as well, being at home with ourselves, really being at peace with ourselves. And in that being at peace with ourselves and feeling at home with ourselves, the world of my mind, in terms of home life, isn't so tight and restricted, and therefore not so much fear going along with it. So it may be necessary and quite appropriate and skillful to stop and to ask, what's being at home for me? What comes when I think of that? Some will say, being at home is where my heart is. Where my heart is. But, of course, heart is delicate. It's a rather vulnerable area and feature of life. And there are some who can't get a sense of being at home. And the mind goes back and say, well, I'm in this country, or I'm in this city, or I'm in this part of the world, and I never really feel at home here, wherever it might be. I thought it would be like this, I thought it would be like that, but what I actually find is like something else. And the mind keeps producing, manufacturing these unsettled thoughts, and one doesn't ever quite feel at home in a place, in a country, in a people, in an area. And it can seem problematic because of the unsettledness. But if one can bear with the unsettledness, maybe it could point to something a little bit deeper. One can bear with the unsettledness. So we just take care and notice what our heart is doing and where it might be going as far as wishing to feel at home. Sometimes, some of you have spoken about this as well, that we shouldn't forget nor neglect in life, in this women and men here, the wishes of the mind and the realities of life. When we look at ourselves, there may be quite strong wishes which is arising inside of oneself. And the wish arises for whatever it might be. The wish arises to be a mother. The wish arises for a close relationship. The wish arises to be alone. The wish arises to spend time and place somewhere. Movement of life going on inside, and there is a wish that goes with it. That wish, even though it's good and understandable, etc., can keep repeating itself. It might be a very private wish, or a wish which one shares with others. And it can keep repeating itself, this wish to get fulfillment in life. But for wishes to get fulfilled, it needs the cooperation of others. And others have their wishes. And it may be that the wishes do meet together and something new flowers from it. But as we know, we can't be assured of it. And if we attend to things that we would wish, we notice what we would wish, but we're watchful and careful about putting our contentment of mind on the wish for something to happen. Can we just, we don't need too much, just enough mindfulness and awareness to watch those kind of private wishes that keep arising, which we would like to happen.
What happens when the wish gets stronger?
One wishes to be home with somebody else, one wishes to accomplish something or whatever.
The wish begins to grow, and from a simple wish it becomes a demand. And we keep saying, why doesn't it happen? Why doesn't it come together? Why doesn't this wish find some fulfillment or completion in my life? And one of the things which human beings often note, we often notice with each other, is that when a wish becomes a demand, many others will see it as a pressure. And they begin to step back. They feel the pressure of wanting, feeling the pressure of the demand, feeling the pressure of this person's expectations, and one steps back, and there's a gap is created. And when the gap is created, the wish becomes a demand, it gets a bit more demanding, more intense, and a bigger gap. And one is doomed to disappointment. So I'm looking at our relationship to the movement of our inner life, to the sense of a home, the sense of relationship with each other. As I say, it takes notice of the quiet wishes of life. Not saying destroying them, trying to negate them, or get rid of them, or whatever. But being truthful and honest, is the wishes becoming demands? We already demand so much of life, and human life, we couldn't fulfill all the demands that we live on life. It's hard to fulfill. Some of you here have, sometimes you say that in the loosening of the mind around things, you say, it can be a wider sense of it. And then some will say, I don't consider my home just where my possessions are. I don't consider my home just where my heart is. Some will say, and they mean it, not a clever turn of phrase or anything, my home on this earth is where my feet are. Where my feet are. That one feels quite at home with that. Still not ultimate realization and understanding of things. Quite at home with life, with the moment, where one is walking, where one is sitting. There's quite at home with it. And there's much less of the trouble and the bothersome anxieties around my home either. In its conventional sense, either having it or not having it. In the tradition, we were talking a little bit about this earlier today, says in the Buddhist tradition, much is said of going from home to homelessness. And in that going from home to homelessness, some people in the West are finding ways to have more time out of home life. I think it's just generating, from my observation, too much pressure on people to feel we should be with the partner at home 7 days a week and maybe a couple of weeks by the Dead Sea or whatever it might be, a year, and that's it. Dead Sea is just about appropriate. And giving and opening and making and creating space and support for people to have relationship and home life and connected life, and simultaneously giving support, as many of your friends, partners, etc. are here, giving support for each other, to know their independence with all the respect that goes with it, the support, with all the respect which goes with it, so that one actually has a sense of spending some time in a monastic atmosphere. Some time in life in homelessness. Some time in life in living in possessions which you do carry in your hand. When I was a monk, the possessions which we had, we could hold our hand out, and they all rested, all of them, on the palm of the hand. Two robes, a begging bowl, and a razor. That was it. Actually, it was more than enough, because we didn't have shape. So, And the appreciation of that, the recognition of that, rather than just doing it, oh, I can only take this amount of my stuff to bring, how content, easy, comfortable you can be with actually having very little in a very simple, basic environment and atmosphere. It matters a great deal. The recognition and appreciation of that can alter significantly the whole notion of living a life in which to have is more important than to be. It's a misplaced relationship to existence. And so instead of being human being, we have become human having, human running after, human getting, human consuming, or whatever. Instead of being Homo sapiens, we've become Homo sapiens. And we haven't realized how far we have got from really being truly, profoundly at home with life. We don't realize how far away, and the further and further away, it's as though nature getting further and further away, as a result of getting further and further away, we suffer more. Those who are furthest away from the sense of being in life, and who are most compelled towards having and having in life, will suffer the effect of it. Somebody said to me today, I was hitchhiking and I'm travelling in a car, and while the driving car, I got picked up, and the driver of the car was an arms dealer. That's not one's favourite form of livelihood. And sometimes one meets such people, and they can appear very cheerful, happy, driving a large, flashy car, very rich, successful, big feelings of self-importance, wheeling and dealing in the arms trade, etc., etc., and have all the kind of external appearance of being successful and confident and clear and emotionally, good spirits, etc. And some people say, well, if the arms dealer can succeed like that, maybe with all my ethics or moralities or whatever, maybe all this thing about right livelihood and so forth is just a kind of good idea. Maybe there's no effect. What I would say is, press a little harder on such people and the cracks will appear. Lean a little harder and something will begin to move. Some of us have met with the wheelers and the dealers in that vulgar trade of selling cigarettes, the corporate world, which sends so many people to addiction. Press a little harder. And they may have all the one-liners as the answers. It's their choice. Every cigarette is a personal choice. We are just providing the public with what they want. Nicotine isn't addictive, etc. It's a matter of individual choices. This is all the one-liners that get used. Press a little harder. The anger might start coming up. The defensiveness might start coming up. The rage might start coming up. Somewhere in the deep, something is seriously wrong. Dealing with things which bring so much terror, suffering, and anguish, not only for the poor victims, but for their friends and loved ones and family and nations, etc. So that's all of that questioning and moving and impacting and connecting with all the rhythm of life. Let's still explore what is it to be at home. What would it mean? We have to be expanding our horizons quite considerably. We'd have to be shaking off some of the labels that we have. It's very easy for you and I to hide behind our labels. When we remember when we were in Nablus, 1518, Israelis came and Palestinians were there, and most of the Palestinians at that table, at that three-day meeting, had been in prison from 2 to 16 years. And in the exchanges that took place, as long as it's Israeli and Palestinian, that label acts as an incredibly difficult filter. Just a label. There's no, where's the Palestinian? Where is the Israeli? Where's the Jew? Where's the English? Where? No, not in this world. It's in a word. It's in an image. And it is going to, and I said to them, you're going to meet, you're going to have to let go of your labels. You can't see each other with labels. You see the Englishman, you can't see. The English too have their dirty fingerprints all over this region, as we know. No different. When we hold the labels very lightly, when the labels are held very, very lightly, meeting takes place. And when they, as the Buddhist tradition has said again and again till it's sick of saying it, when we hold the labels in a holding fashion, we can never, ever meet. Period. Those who hold will never see each other. There's not a hope, not a chance. And those who just see, it's just a word appearing out of the mind. And that's all it is. There's no inherent truth, significance. It's just a word appearing out of the mind, and another word appearing out of another mind, and that's all it is we can see. And when we see, change can come. And when we don't see, we get what we get. Everybody. So, shifting things inside contribute significantly to shifting things outside. In the shifting inner and the shifting outer takes place, it opens up the doors of perception. It opens things up. In that opening things up, as we were hearing in the inquiry today, sometimes it begins to raise for us larger questions about life. Who am I? From not the label, and all the identification that's built up around it. I really am not that, and can't possibly be that. And if my home can disappear before my eyes, because somebody, some authority takes it away from me, because I don't want it anymore, and therefore home is as fluctuating a thing as anything else, who am I? What is it to be really at home? In some of the experiences here which have been reported, sometimes in the opening of the consciousness, we're not kind of so rushing towards things, and the world of mine and not mine, that big gap, begins to get, hopefully, a little bit less. Just for convention, as I said with the young man earlier, that my watch, my shirt, or whatever, just convention. And the world of solid mine and solid not mine, and that division, isn't quite so real. It doesn't seem to be quite the real world that my mind kept showing to me. So my awareness is expanding, and it's revealing things, shall we say, more equally. There are items appearing in awareness there, and things are just appearing more equally at every level. I acknowledge others' labels, I acknowledge my own, etc. All just appearing in this field of light. And there's a certain receptivity there. The world isn't so divided, mine and not mine, and it's more interrelated because it's not so divided in the way that we've been conditioned. Could it be that in that receptivity, without the potency of that dualism, mine and not mine, could it be I'm close to something? I'm actually closer to something, which is closer than my thoughts. Closer than my thoughts. Some of you, more group, one-to-ones, whatever. That's it. But Christopher, sometimes I have that sense. And it comes, I have that experience. I know something of what you're talking about. It's not a vague theory or an abstraction or whatever. I felt it. But then I find that my mind comes back in much the same way that it was. And once again, I'm yelling at my neighbors. Or, don't you dare touch it, it's mine. And the old pattern of the fragmented world is back strongly. Why is it that there is such a gap between these kind of awarenesses and insights and experiences, and somehow it seems like the mind doesn't get the message. And the old mind comes back, and it's back into the same loop. And therefore, there is a gap between that which I know or have sensed or experienced or felt or been touched by and the world that I live in. And sometimes people will say, well, what the hell's the use of having all these deep meditation experiences and all these altered states of consciousness and all these mind-opening events and big awarenesses and choiceless observations and meetings with God and touched by the truth and cosmic events. If I am still a selfish, greedy, negative, anxious, worrying, fretting individual afterwards, what's the point? There's my mind like this and there's this and perhaps I have it once a year for 2.3 seconds on a retreat. And then I'm back for the old self. Why is there this gap? Why is there this gap? Why doesn't that expansiveness automatically translate that I can easily accommodate my mother and father, or my neighbors, near or far, or the empty bank account, or whatever it is that winds one up? Why is there a gap? It's as though we've separated in life the ocean from the waves. In a sense of something expansive, like the ocean is expansive. And there are the waves of our everyday life, our work, our studies, our activities, our interests, our hobbies, our whatever. And all the little things of life which make up our human existence. Seems like the ocean and the waves, little things like that, all got separated from each other. Seems like there's a gap. There's no gap really, but it appears like that. When that gap gets rather big, in the gap tends to come doubt. Had these experiences, whatever it might be, well, they're obviously not doing any good. Why bother? Why not just go back to the lazy, self-indulgent self. Not easy thing to live with. That gap. Not easy for a man or a woman who has tasted of something other. Felt something other, been touched with something other, brief or longer, and then there's daily life. Going to work on Monday, coming home and Friday, I don't do that, do you? No, whatever days you. Can that expansive sense be even when it fades away, there's no feeling of it, there's no kind of direct experience of it,
not turning to memory. But can that expansive sense be a resource, the important question here, be a resource for wisdom in the face of the waves of life? Can in some way, on something immeasurable and unshakable, can that in some way inform us? In a way that our thinking of thinking about doesn't. And sometimes the informing of us might come through our feeling, we call it intuition, we might. It might come through thinking. It might come through sudden awareness. It might come through our body. It might come through a bird on the wing, the night sky, what a little child says, or whatever. But there's a sense that it's coming from something greater than just me, me, me. The quality of the experience of expansive, immeasurable sense of life, as I said, may fade. We don't have to turn to memory. Perhaps we could just be still enough for a moment or two, in which we're not demanding anything of life. We're just still, not demanding anything of ourselves, anything of anybody else in the world, not wanting for anything. Perhaps in such moments, there's a certain expansiveness beyond the demanding self. Could that inform us in a way that the demanding self never can, never can? Could we listen in another language, we say, can we listen to the mind of God? Can the receptivity touch in another way that informs? If it is informing, the I, me and the my of possessiveness goes down noticeably. The fears and the worries wrapped up with it go down noticeably. The greed goes down noticeably. Because how could the measurable, which is what greed goes for the measurable, how could the measurable ever be a substitute for the immeasurable? Who could be greedy for money and possessions and status and the fluctuating things of life when he or she has tasted of that which is immeasurable? So the sense of the immeasurable takes out the demand on life, therefore it takes out the anger, which is the outcome of demands which are unfulfilled. It takes out the greed, because the greed goes for the finite and the measurable. It takes out the self-delusion, because one is deluded in thinking happiness is in that which is born and dying, coming and going. The very sense of the immeasurable takes out the problems of the mind in its greed form, in its aggressive form, in its fearful form, in its worrying form. Truth of that heals, and it ends the gap. How? Mind can't fathom it out. How is it? It's immeasurable. Transforms human life in a way which, with all of our cleverness, and all of our knowledge, and all of our expertise, we can't do. May all beings live with awareness. May all beings be touched by the immeasurable. May all beings live a liberated life. Let's have our couple of quiet minutes together, please.